Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. It's episode 5 and this week is Steve Berry, as you can probably see by the title. Dan, how's it going?
I'm doing well, Rob. How about you?
Yeah, very good, very good.
What have you been up to this week?
What have I been doing?
Did I see you had a gig on Facebook?
I tell you what you've seen. It belongs in the news. There's this promo video for Andy Scott and Group S, Ruby and All Things Purple, which is essentially the third album of Andy's band Sax Assault, which has been rebranded. Yeah, he did one, I think, in 96 and then in 2006. And then this one is coming out next month. So there tends to be quite a lot of composition and development or whatever. So that first album, I was at school. The second one, I was at college. And the third one, if you look closely at those videos, if you Google Group S or Ruby and All Things Purple, the promo comes up. It's about a minute long. There's three like flash shots of me in action.
Great, I'll have to check it out.
It's very exciting.
I love that you having a gig is jazz news.
Absolutely, there's only three segments in the news, and one of them is that I have played my saxophone.
Well, congrats!
Yeah,
what else happened?
So there's also a podcast that Andy's on called The Sax Show. Which if you're itching for more of Andy and you're not getting it from us, then our friends over there, a friend of ours, Alistair Penman, is the co-host, and they interviewed Andy a couple of weeks ago. So that's somewhere you can go if you want more saxophone, more Andy Scott, less Steve Berry, less jazz.
I think I said it before, but it got edited out, but I don't really care much for the saxophone.
You chose
to edit that out. Try and get it in. I'll see if it makes the cut this week. I don't know if it will.
Oh no! Good for you. Good for you, man. Sticking at it. I apologise for
censoring
me. In a land of free speech, I've censored your opinion about the saxophone. Yeah.
So I've had. I know last week we were talking about the jazz lookalikes. I found one.
Oh wow!
I found a good one.
Tell me.
Can you? Alec Dankworth.
Mm-hmm.
Get a photo of him up right now.
Doing it. Alec Dankworth. Yeah, okay.
What do you think? Nigel Farage.
Ooh.
Is that a good one? I'm not sure.
Oh, well, I quite like that it's controversial.
So I found something else that we could laugh about.
Oh, yeah, tell me.
So I don't know if you... after you came up with the lookalikes last week, I thought, oh, I'll have to think of something else. And I remembered that I can't remember who showed me, but there's a guy called David Newton. I don't know if you've come across him. He's a piano player.
No,
on
I haven't.
Website, he has one of the tabs is alternative professions.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't. Tell
me. Oh, it's great. So what he's done is he's taken probably a couple of hundred, maybe a couple of hundred jazz musicians, and based on their genetic looks, has come up with what their alternate profession would be.
Wow.
And so I thought I'd share a few of my favourite ones. You can get it up if you like. It's davidnewton.biz.
David, this is good for the listeners as well. davidnewton.biz.
.biz, B-I-Z.
Yeah.
Why you'd choose a .biz, I don't know. go on there and then alternative profession. So I'll give you a few. So for example, Stan Saltzman, right?
Yeah.
His alternate profession would be a retired UK heavyweight champion boxer.
Oh, that's great.
Obviously, that's perfect, isn't it? That just sums him up.
That's absolutely perfect.
Another one I like, you know Mark Armstrong?
Yeah.
He's Ross Nigel.
Yeah.
Archbishop's assistant.
That's very nice.
That was a great one. What other ones did I find? Martin Speak.
Mm-hmm.
Washing machine soap powder scientist.
I can imagine that being taken very seriously by Martin. He would certainly make some great washing powder.
He really would, wouldn't he? Mm. Or at least, you know, make it 5% better.
Yes. Time to make that better.
Kit Downs, photography student, and then in brackets, Nottingham.
Oh, wow, that's cool. That's very topical because Kit is next week's show.
Yeah, exactly. We've got James Madron is one of Robin Hood's merry men.
Yeah, that's perfect. Suppose we should play Steve's episode.
Yeah, do you want to play the episode?
Let's do it. Here he comes. On my left, a man I've just cooked dinner for, Steve Berry. How are you doing, Steve?
Very well fed, thank you very much.
Excellent.
Very happy.
So it was a traditional, like, Indian lentil curry is what it was meant to be. What were your thoughts?
Well, I don't know if I had any thoughts about traditional lentil curry other than yum. I have very plain, simple thoughts.
That's good.
And also, I'm no expert, so I wasn't evaluating it and comparing it with other great curries I've had.
Fair enough.
But it's certainly up there with
okay,
them.
Okay, that's good.
But I couldn't give you specifics.
Okay. Obviously, I'm nervous because you're a vegetarian. I'm cooking on your territory, you know? There's no meat. There's nothing I can use to... I mean, the vegetables don't lie. If it's bad, it's not going to taste good.
Vegetables don't lie. Yeah, I never thought of that. But I think you've got to realise that this is worth putting on record. I am a rubbish cook, right?
Interesting.
When I first met Catherine, who's obviously been my wife for this last 30 plus years, I cooked a meal for her once when we were dating, and it took me 3 hours and it was disgusting. And she said to me as we ate this meal in sort of a morbid silence, she said, I hope you don't mind, she said, but when we live together, would it be okay if I do most of the cooking? Which was, of course, a win for me because I never had the talent for it anyway. And she's amazing. So that was a deal right there.
Wow, that's a great start.
Yes.
Fantastic. So where did you grow up in Blackburn? Because you live there now.
No, didn't grow up in Blackburn. Blackburn was the place that Catherine and I moved to in 1989,
right.
December 89.
Okay.
But having both been living in London before that, but I moved to London from Shropshire, and Shropshire's where I did most of my main growing up.
Right.
And my dad was in the fire service, so every time he was promoted, we moved. So from when I was born till when I was six, I think we lived in something like 5 places.
Oh, wow.
And then Shropshire, which is where we ended up at that point, was where I think he decided that was where he definitely wanted to stick, because he loved the Welsh mountains. And so he enjoyed being close enough to be able to just, at short notice, be in Snowdonia. So that's why Shrewsbury was where he put down his roots finally.
Oh, wow.
So that's where I did most of my primary and all of my secondary education. And then I moved from Shropshire to London,
right,
to become a musician,
yeah,
basically.
Did your dad get any kind of danger pay? Is that a thing in the fire service, you know, because you are, like, risking life and limb?
That's a good point. I don't know if that's the case. I suspect it's probably more a question of if something happens to you, like if you get injured or killed in a fire, then I guess they must... this is a complete... guesswork, by the way. They may have some sort of things built in there, but no, other than that, it was just one of the services, because he'd been in the army, and it sort of very much agreed with him to have a job that was still had a lot of service overtones to
right
it. But no, I don't know,
because as far as I'm aware, and I'm no expert, in the army you do get paid more if you're on tour. You know, in like a war zone, there's a financial incentive to go and risk your ass.
There's a problem there, though.
What?
Because if you get like bonuses for attending fires,
yeah,
Well, you're going to start fires, aren't you?
Encouraging arson. Yeah. I realised after I asked it that it was a stupid question. But
it's an interesting thought.
Yeah, yeah. So enough of our specialism. The Fire Services podcast can wait.
Okay.
So when you moved to London to become a musician, what instrument were you playing?
At that point, still playing guitar and electric bass.
Right.
And it was whilst I made that move to London that I also had in the back of my mind to take up double bass. Mm-hmm. Because although I was playing fretless bass guitar, mostly was when I played bass, it was on fretless bass. Because I'd been sort of bamboozled by Jaco, as indeed everybody did at that time, mm-hmm. or everybody was at that time. And but the more music I listened to and immersed myself in, the more I was hearing double bass rather than electric bass.
Right,
and I sort of was heading in an acoustic direction.
Yeah,
if I can put it that way. So yeah, not long after moving to London, I bought a yellow plywood double bass through the Exchange and Mart from a family in Box Hill, I think.
Right.
A bright yellow plywood double bass.
Wow. Is plywood a good wood for a bass?
It's good in terms of durability.
Yes.
It's terrible in terms of sound and resonance. But, ironically, years later, I can see advantages to having basses like that when you're amplified on a large stage in a large venue. Because the bass I have now is phenomenally resonant and incredibly loud. Mm-hmm. But it's a nightmare to amplify in large venues because the sound incoming to the front of the instrument from the speakers just gets retransmitted straight back through the bass because it's so responsive.
Right.
But if you've got a real turkey of a sort of concrete bass and you're in those situations, doesn't matter how loud it gets, you're not going to get any feedback resonances to worry about.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of people, you know, a lot of my friends do that. They have a bass for that situation.
Yeah.
And then they have a different bass for when they're playing acoustically. But I... rather than having lots of basses, we had four children instead. And so I've just got one bass.
Fantastic. I wanted to ask you about your kids. So I remember you telling me many years ago, before I'd met any of your family, that you had a family band called yes. A Bunch of Berries.
I think that was an informal title. That's true.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
How did it come about that they all became interested in music as well? Is that a coincidence or...?
In a way it is, because, yeah. I mean, they grew up in a home filled with music and musicians, because, like, I would have people coming to the house to rehearse all the time. I would be going out gigging all the time. And so it was just part of their environment, and they didn't know any different. And as far as they may have been aware, everybody's home was like that, you know?
Yeah.
pardon me. So I think it's only when they went to school that they realised that other people did other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, I suppose also that they could see the amount of fulfilment that went with what was happening in and around the house and in around the work that particularly I was doing. That it's going to infect them with, like, well, basically that looks like fun, you know. And so they were very naturally drawn to it, and of course we encouraged them all to play. They all started playing instruments like as soon as they could walk, really. But it just seemed like a very natural thing, and I don't remember at any point. I certainly know this didn't happen. Is that Catherine and I never sat down and had this great plan like let's make them musicians.
Yeah.
And, you know, and certainly there would never be the thought of, like, let's give them a life as musicians because then they will never have any money or or any respect.
No.
You know, like, yeah. No parent would do that.
No parent. I'm sure no parent would ever wish that their child takes on a life as a musician. so I don't for a minute accuse you of bullying them into it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a while where I thought Daniel was going to get into politics.
Yeah.
Because he was, I think, he'd entertained the idea of doing politics, philosophy and economics at the LSE. And then he just was like, one day, it was like, nah, musician.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. And I remember at the time, I was talking to him about it, and I thought he was going into politics, but he was very much a left-wing politician, political persuasion, and he did a lot with Socialist Workers' Party and stuff like that. And he just laughed when I asked him about it. He said, Dad, he said, if you think there's any sort of financial inducement to moving away from music into left-wing politics or vice versa, he said, it ain't like that. They're both as benighted as each
other. Fantastic, yeah. So what's it like to play with them now?
It's great. It's great. I mean, it just feels really natural. Always has, to be fair.
Yeah, because two of the four are like professional musicians.
Well,
is that a fair assumption?
Probably better to say four of the four.
Okay.
Really.
Okay.
It's just that in terms of the sort of work that I do, the crossover is more natural between the eldest two. Whereas Jacob, for instance, he never really ever wanted to study jazz or be a jazz musician.
Yeah.
And he never really got the taste for that. And I think, you know, he always wanted to be a songwriter and work in singer-songwriter and pop music and rock. And so that's where he's always sort of aimed towards.
Right.
So the likelihood of me and him turning up on a gig together is very unlikely, whereas Jessica and Daniel both do some of the work that I do, just quite naturally.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it just feels really normal, to be honest.
That's cool. I love it. So I want to ask you about Loose Tubes. With the start of that, you've moved to London,
mm-hmm.
and let's just forget about the guitar. I assume you were no good.
No, that's not true. I just took a real bum steer at a crucial moment.
Yeah.
Right? It's worth you knowing about this, because I was very, very taken with Ralph Towner.
Yes.
I loved Ralph Towner's work. Bill Connors had done some acoustic work as well with Jan Gabarek. So I had a taste for and an idea about doing guitar and within an improvised jazz context, but I had very little knowledge or awareness of who did what on guitar. I had very little awareness of anything, to be fair, at that point. And when I got to London, the plan was that I would do guitar, but also bass as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that when I bought this double bass that I was starting from scratch, square one. And with the guitar, I had in mind that, you know, if you were to put it in crude terms, I was very taken with Egberto Gismonti is another one I should mention as well, yeah. and Ralph Towner.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of jazz playing that I really could relate to.
Yeah.
And then on double bass, there would be Palle Danielsson, there would be Dave Holland, etc., and all the greats like Ron Carter and stuff. And so I was sort of guided by those thoughts. Uh-huh. So I also knew that Ralph Towner had studied classically in Vienna, with a great virtuoso classical teacher, as well as all his jazz credentials. So I thought, that's got to be a good idea. And I'd never had lessons in my life anyway. I was completely self-taught. So I thought, I'm going to get, inspired by what Ralph had done, I thought, I will get some classical guitar lessons. So I found out that they had evening lessons at the Guildhall School of Music, and I phoned up and got an audition with Senor Albanez. And Senor Albanez was, in fact, the real deal Spanish classical guitar teacher.
What a name. That's fantastic. Yeah.
So I had this audition lesson with him, and he asked me to play for him. So I got my guitar out, got my footstool. I'd managed to get the footstool thing because I'd mm-hmm. seen that done, and I thought, mm-hmm. that must be cool, right? and I played a couple of pieces that I'd written. I'd composed a couple of COD quasi-classical whatever for him. And I, when I finished the second piece, I looked up for the first time, and at the other end of the room, I saw him with his head bowed, with his hand on his forehead, and with his head going from side to side slowly. And he didn't speak. So I was sitting there for a while, like, this is awkward. And then I said, Senor Albaneth, I believe the lessons would start in 3 weeks' time, they told me. And I just wondered, is there anything, any advice you'd give me before the lessons start? And there was an equally long pause. And then he went, my friend, do not touch the guitar. That was his advice. Right? And I thought, well, that's pretty bad, isn't it? That must mean I'm at square one here. And because I'd already decided to take on double bass, and I thought, well, I'll be at square one on that anyway. And I thought, screw it, I'll just do double bass then, just put all my energy into that.
Yeah.
Because, like, that was such a crushing sort of moment that he gave me there.
Yeah.
And to be fair, when I spoke to Ralph Towner about that many years later, he was gutted and he was furious, you know.
Really?
He said, man, you should have come and seen me.
Yeah.
Which is true.
Yeah.
And of course, that would never have occurred to me.
No, of course. Wow.
You know, it's like, I wouldn't have known where he lived even. He was just like a mythical creature on a couple of albums that I had.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was what happened.
So it's really even more painful that I just accused you of being no good at the guitar.
You actually know Senor Albaneth, don't you?
Yeah.
And you're actually in his employ.
Yeah,
I knew it.
He's funding this whole podcast just so we could talk about this.
I just had a sense of that, you know, in your email.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Apologies. It didn't, yeah. So tell me about how the Loose Tubes thing.
Mm.
Obviously, something that's cool about it looking back is that there's a lot of names in it that you can kind of read down, and people that are still playing now. And so today it still feels really it could like be a band that started tomorrow, you know? It doesn't feel like it was, I don't know how many years ago, but...
We're talking when it first came together was in 84.
Right. And how long had you been in London when this came together?
Well, I moved in the autumn of 1979. So I'd been there for 4 or 5 years at that point.
And the formation of it, was it quite an organic thing that you were already playing with these guys and you kind of just decided to give yourselves a name?
Well, the short version, for everybody's sake, because I mean, it's out there now anyway, people know this.
Yeah.
Graham Collier got some money from the Arts Council to form an alternative to Nigel, effectively. And it was to be a big band that would welcome into it young up-and-coming musicians who wouldn't necessarily fall within the orbit of Nigel.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, he's thinking about free improvisers, people doing original music, and who haven't got a great affinity with the whole bassy tradition that maybe underscored Nigel at that time.
Yeah.
So that was the idea behind it. And so we found ourselves together in this rehearsal band that Graham Collier had received funding to start. And then what he did was he would get guest directors in each week, and we would do the music of Roger Dean. We'd do the music of maybe John Taylor came in one time, maybe Kenny Wheeler, I don't know. But they would bring their charts along. some people, I don't even remember who we had. But because we were there in that room, some of us also thought we could write some stuff. So increasingly, stuff emerged from within our ranks, principally originally from Django and myself. And when we played the music we'd written for ourselves, there was something about it that really agreed with us. Like, you couldn't put words to it, really. It was kind of like, this is our music.
Mm-hmm.
And Graham Collier was obviously one of the contributors to providing music for us to play, but we sort of got this sense that we should really do this. And, you know, it's great that all these other people have written music for big bands and whatever. Yeah. But what we were doing is we were writing for who we were. Like, you know, you didn't write a guitar part. You wrote a part for John Parricelli.
Yeah.
And because you knew John at that time, you knew what sort of thing was good for him. So that it was more bespoke, if you like.
Yeah.
And so the band sort of evolved out of that project. And so there was a point where it achieved its own sort of escape velocity, and it stopped being Graham's project and it became our band. Mm-hmm. And the name even was chosen in sort of some cussedness.
Yeah.
Because like we were deciding what should we be called. And I think a name that would have gone down very well from Graham's point of view and would have released untold amounts of Arts Council funding would be something like the London Youth Alternative Creative Music Project, right? And we knew the hell we were not going to be called that. And so we came up with the name Loose Tubes, which got a very bad reaction from Graham. Of like, you'll never get any funding. And we were like, that's definitely our name then. Because we were a bit sort of, we were young blokes, you know, we didn't know how to behave.
Yeah.
And so we were, I think back then we could have done it all a lot better, but that was the way we did it because we were young guys full of spunk, as the Australians say it. Yeah. You know? But that's how.
Yeah.
Basically.
I'm sure, I mean, you know, Arts Council funding, that could be another whole podcast of its own and how to go about it, because it seems to me that there is definitely a system that's there to be played to an extent with the decisions you make with your band. And I mean, that's not a criticism, that's just how it is. You know, like you say, like you could have chosen a really appropriate name or you could choose whatever you want.
We chose a really inappropriate one.
That's great. Precisely. And I'm sure that kind of contributes to the energy and the youthful vibe, you know, that you're not... Yeah.
Well, the sobriquet that got attached to it a lot at the time was irreverent.
Yeah.
And yeah, we certainly were that. And I think a lot of people read that as disrespectful as well. So it did ruffle some feathers at the time as well.
Yeah.
But the funding thing that you allude to there, yeah, it's a really tangled web that I've never been able to figure out. And with Loose Tubes, we just cut some lucky breaks, but also Colin Lazzarini, who became the band's manager eventually, he was a very canny operator. And he actually was very good at interacting with the Arts Council and bodies like that on our behalf. Without him, we could never have done it. But also the Musicians Union were very into it, and they were helping Ronnie Scott's at the time as well. So we got to do Ronnie Scott's for a week or a fortnight, I think, and it was in early 86 or late 85. And there was a sort of a wellspring of a buzz about the band that was building up around London. And then Joanna Lumley saw the band at Ronnie Scott's and raved to Terry Wogan about it. So we ended up playing on the Terry Wogan show.
Wow.
Because of Joanna Lumley. There's all sorts of things that helped to open doors, if you like, at the time. Things like that made a big difference. And the residencies at Ronnie's were sort of things of legend. They really took off. And the Arts Council noticed and were like, you know, we have to help this. So there was a big Arts Council tour in 86, which I think they were more than happy to support because they could see there was something happening and was catching fire. And so it was a confluence of lots of things that came together at the right time.
It seems to me, again, not to get all political, but that's a really nice way around for the situation to unfold. That first of all, you create something and there's an interest in it. Mm. And at that point, there becomes some funding to help you guys to take it, rather than kind of create a project and get some funding before you've even played a gig.
No, it's quite unusual for that, absolutely. But there's a downside to that as well, though, because it meant that the band formed in a fairly chaotic, cooperative way.
Yes.
And that was the way that the band tried to operate. And yeah. And it just became more and more unmanageable.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that very anarchic sort of non-constitution that we had.
Yeah.
So the lack of sort of nous became very, 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 very obviously the problem. Yeah. So, because you imagine if you have a bunch of people meet just randomly in an open space, mm. and then it's like, hey, this is great. Hey, I really like you. And then you all sort of suddenly it's like, hey, this is great. And then imagine everybody says, hey, I've got an idea. Let's go here. And it's like 21 different directions. And then like, you can't do that. You can't just all walk away from each other going to different places. So you need some sort of governing nous there. And the band never really had that. And mm-hmm. That became its undoing in yeah. the end. So the happy accident of its formation and the material creating the enthusiasm, the creating the band, yeah, it was all very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point early on, which was never going to happen because we were all way too young and inexperienced. But if someone amongst us had said, hey, we need to think about this, this and this, because down the road, this could be a problem. Well, no one in the band was even capable of thinking like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was kind of chaotic.
Yeah. Really. It kind of makes me feel how I feel about like Monty Python, you know. The jazz equivalent of a like Monty Python situation, you know, so many big personalities. tell me about the Ronnie's reunion. That was last year,
Or even the year before, I think.
Or the year before,
It was 2014, I think.
Wow, cool! Yeah, that has gone fast.
And the band,
was that also a happy accident? You kind of just
not at all, not at all.
I didn't think so, but
no. And, I mean, 2014 was the 30th anniversary of the band forming.
Right.
Okay. So that was the magic number. And I would guess that primarily it's down to two people only, which would be Django and his manager, Jeremy Farnell.
Django Bates. Django just Bates. To be clear, yes. In case anyone's listening, utterly
not,
confused.
Not Django Reinhardt. No. He was never in the band. I've never played with him. We've never met.
Clarification. Yes, you needed it.
Absolutely. And but I think Django and his manager had noticed that date coming up, probably some years ago, and hatched an idea that grew. And so the idea became that the band would reform and do hopefully a broadcast and some gigs. And so obviously Jeremy worked incredibly hard in the background putting that together. And without Jeremy and Django thinking that way and intending that to happen, I don't think it ever could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means that it's a very different animal at that point. Because that's Loose Tubes re-emerging definitely with a hand on the tiller, one hand.
Yeah.
And so that it had that sort of guiding thought, guiding principle behind it to enable it to come into being, which is, if you like, is the antithesis of how the band originally came together. So it always would have needed someone to decide, right, we're doing this.
Yeah.
And it was Django who had that thought, I think. And the thing basically boiled down to the band as it existed in 91, which was the point where it ceased to exist, that as far as possible, that lineup would be the re-emerging lineup.
Right.
So it's like to carry on where it left off.
Oh, very nice.
Personnel-wise.
Yeah.
but also to involve the likes of myself compositionally as a sort of nod towards my original involvement, if you like.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. I wrote a piece for the reunion. That's about the size of it.
Wow, cool. Let's move forwards a little bit, because more recently you have become a prolific jazz educator. You know, it's very convenient for people like me because I can look up to you so much as a musician, as a performer, as an improviser, but also as an educator, and for the amount that you've done to give people of the younger generation, I guess, the same enthusiasm and opportunities that motivated you to play.
Mm.
And everybody I know knows who you are. You know, in the world of jazz, at least, you're like totally...
If only I knew who
yeah,
I was.
Yeah, you know, a That'd household name. That's something, isn't it? You know? So the other thing about teaching nowadays, obviously, is for me, that's like how you can actually pay your rent.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite a big part of being a professional musician. If you want to be a musician, like, you can do a show, you can teach, but there's not that many things, you know? Mm. I wanted to ask you whether you purposefully struck such a good balance in your life.
Well, I can answer that quite clearly for you, because at the point where Loose Tubes formed and was very active, that did provide some income for me as a composer in terms of royalties and also as a player with the gigs. But that in and of itself could not have supported me and our family. Players like Ian Bellamy, Django, Steve Arguelles, like, they were already at that point sort of emerging stars of the scene at the time. So as well as doing Loose Tubes, they were doing, like, Django and Ian for a while were with Bill Bruford's Earthworks. Django did a lot with Duda Pakwana, etc., etc. And so you'd find that they had various gigs and projects as well as Loose Tubes, and that all came amalgamated to a living. And for me, the work I did outside of Loose Tubes that amalgamated to a living was some local jazz gigs to London, but also I did shows, musicals, and a couple of West End shows. And that was going to be, if you like, my other strand to my income. And whenever I did a show, that was the only time I experienced that idea of having something like steady money for a while. And then out of Loose Tubes, there were some music workshops that were lined up for us to do. And that was my first contact with and experience with music education at all, because having been largely self-taught, I had no concept of the music establishment, educational establishment. But there was something about taking these workshops that really excited me. And I just pretty much immediately knew that I loved that situation. Like, as a performer, that you've got to go onto a stage in a room and something amazing has to happen for it to be worthwhile, you know. And it's the thing, it's the electricity of the thing that draws you forward. And I found I had a similar experience with music workshops. Suddenly you're in a room with maybe 35 people you've never met before in your life, and something good has to happen in the next hour and a half or 2 hours, which is really exciting. It's challenging, but also it's very direct and immediate, because you're in such a small space with these fellow humans, and the only thing that unites all of you is an interest in or a passion in music and making music. So this was my first contact with music education, really, and I just knew pretty much straight away I really, really loved it. But it never occurred to me then that could be a living. It just... It was like, these are nice occasional things to do.
Yeah.
But one thing led to another, and you found that the phone rang more and more often for people asking you to do it, which I would like to think meant that the previous ones I'd done had gone well enough that people liked it enough to want to do it again. So in a way, it created its own momentum. It's like I must have been, for want of a better expression, I must have been doing something right. Mm-hmm. But it was all purely by intuition. I wasn't a trained educator. And I wasn't even a student myself. I'd never been properly a student of music, so I didn't know how it all worked. So I was making it up as I went along, really. But something really agreed with me about it, and I couldn't have expressed it any more clearly than I did just then. But that eventually meant that the income I used to get from doing musicals and shows became completely supplanted by teaching work. And I really, personally, really liked that. Because I found that every time I went in to teach or workshop, it was a challenge every time. And it doesn't have a set outcome. And it's only going to be as good as you allow it and help it to be. Whereas with the show, once you've nailed it and you've got it all right, you find that in week 8 of a show, every note is going in the right place, and you're not listening and you're not even thinking about the music or the show. Your head is somewhere else. And I always used to find that upsetting. I didn't like playing like that, and I didn't want my playing to become like that. So the idea of supplanting that situation with the teaching was, for me, was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And it's only subsequently, as I've done more teaching, that I've been able to learn as I've gone along how to teach, and also how to improve that teaching. And crucial in the early phase of that, in the early 90s, was when I got to become one of the tutors on the Glamorgan Summer School. And so therefore you spend a week or sometimes two cheek by jowl with Simon Purcell, Julian Siegel, Stan Saltzman, John Paracelli, you name it, all these great musicians and players. And so it became like a melting pot for ideas. And you'd see, you know, a friend take a session, and you'd get a real sense of like, wow, that was great. And I would learn as much on that summer school as I supposedly taught.
Yeah.
If you like, I got very inspired by that. So it very much sort of grew organically for me, and it was a total surprise to me as well. I would have never have seen that coming.
Yeah.
I think the only musicians who taught I'd encountered on gigs, and you got this thing of like that teaching was the pain in the ass thing that you had to do to make enough to live, that enabled you to be a creative player. And so it had this real cloud hanging over it. And yet I knew it wasn't like that for me. And many times I found that a day's teaching would be more fulfilling than the supposed gig in the evening. You know, one of my pet hates is a jazz gig where no jazz is happening, where no one's listening and there's no improvisation happening.
Yeah.
And like that makes me as cold as death. I hate those gigs.
Yeah.
Where the spirit of the music is being trashed and misrepresented, right? And so there I am supposedly doing a jazz gig in an evening, and actually will be playing thinking, I had such a great time today with those students and they did such amazing things. And so sometimes it's actually been the guiding sort of inspiration for me more than the gigs. That's happily a minority of gigs that fall into that category, because you very often make a point of, yeah, I don't do that band anymore, or I don't do that gig anymore.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, situations conspire and you find yourself in that situation. And at this point, 30 years later, it's quite clear to me that my work and my raison d'etre is primarily the education work. I've got more of a fire in my belly about that now than I ever have. And it's like I spend more time thinking about, caring about, and doing that than I think about whatever that thing is we call my music, you know. And I love to play. And every time I do a gig, it feels like a bonus on top of the teaching life that I have. And they do, to some extent, feed each other. And I find that I've learned a lot about playing through teaching and learning about it with other players. And I include that, you know, with young players at school. You know, you'll learn something there that immediately feeds back into your own playing. It's incredibly generative and healthy.
Yeah.
So for me, I've never had that thing of like the teaching is the pain in the ass thing that you do to make up the money, mm-hmm. you know. And I remember Simon Purcell, who is just as passionate, if not more so, as an educator. He was telling me about an interview that he gave an interview for, they were looking for a teacher for something. And there's Simon on the panel there. Who else? This must have been somewhere like Trinity or Guildhall, I guess. And this guy's being interviewed and asked, you know, why do you want this job? Like the guy said, well, you know, I can't get quite enough gigs. And so I might as well do this. And he's saying that to Simon.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's you might as well just stab yourself in the chest, you know. Because Simon cares so passionately about education and learning.
Yeah.
And he's like, why do you want this job? Because, you know, the answer, no-brainer, is I love music and I love people and I love working with people and music. And I find, you know, teaching other people about music is incredibly healthy, and also I learn more. You know, if that person had said that, there'd have been more to the interview.
Yeah.
But at the point where they said what they did say, for Simon it was like, that interview was over right there, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I digress.
No, I enjoyed that a lot. I was just distracted because I've written in my notes here, Steve, you're like the love child of Winston Churchill and the weatherman Michael Fish.
Wow.
How do you feel about that?
Pretty upset.
I was thinking of, I mean, because both of them have a certain authority.
Because I'm now seeing Winston Churchill and Michael Fish in a clinch, and that's pretty upsetting.
Think of the personalities more. That's what
Okay.
A sense of authority and a sense of, you know, people take you very seriously when you start talking about...
Okay, well, so there's you know, a guy who basically was...
we're talking about Fish here.
No, well, on the one hand, there's Churchill, who's a really strong, forceful, egotistical leader.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Michael Fish, who failed to spot a hurricane in 1987 and resulted in lots of fatalities and buildings being wrecked.
Yeah.
And I remind you of them.
No.
Explain.
Well, I feel bad for Michael Fish. You know? Yeah, he's, I guess, that one situation's
I think put a cloud over his the rest of his life.
Yeah, to be fair, it did, I suppose. Yeah.
A fast-spinning cloud.
Yeah. Yeah, I was on the train when I wrote that down, and I can't quite remember what I meant by it now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, just out of curiosity, did you ever have another job that wasn't musical just to make ends meet when you were, well, at any point?
Yes. When I moved to London, as I did in late 79, I had my livelihood before I learnt to hold a double bass and not fall over.
Mm-hmm.
My life was sustained by supplementary benefit. I was on the dole.
Right.
Effectively, I think for about 2 years I signed on, and that was my university grant, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to sign on one day, and the person signing on said, look, you've declared these earnings for 6 consecutive weeks now where you haven't received any benefit because you've been self-supporting. They said, it looks to us like you're a professional musician now, so why don't you just sign off? And I didn't sign off because I thought, well, you know, it might all stop tomorrow. And then a couple of weeks later, I realized, no, I'm a musician. So I signed off.
Wow.
And that must have been in 81 or something.
Yeah.
And that was when I turned professional as a musician.
That's great. And what a fantastic story that someone in the like job seeker office has said to you, Steve, it looks to me like you're a professional musician.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's like my art professors when I did my 2 years of my art degree, when they said I should take a year out, it was because they said, we think you might be a musician. So it seems like I'm probably the last person to have realised this.
This is fantastic. I love these. They make it sound like it's like a diagnosis. Like, you're gonna have to take some time out, Steve. You know, we're worried about you.
Yes, I think that's fair.
That's great. Go and deal with it.
Yes.
And then come back.
And now I know whose love child I am. I'm also very worried about me.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, it has been a pleasure. Steve, Berry, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for a lovely meal as well.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. I used to sneeze like a civilized person all my life.
Yeah.
And then some years ago at Lipper, I did a couple of sneezes. And then for the rest of the morning, I noticed people were looking at me a bit weird.
Yeah.
And then I went to the bathroom, had a slash, and then washing my hands, looked in the mirror. And the whites of both my eyes were just red.
Oh, man.
And I burst all the blood vessels in my eyeballs because the power of the sneeze, which I'd suppressed, sort of put a lot of pressure. And I had the red eyeballs for 2 weeks. And the optician had, around that time, also said, you've got a hardened retina, so I'm on danger alert for detached retina. So no extreme sports. I said, no danger.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But also she said, and with that happening when you sneeze, she said, you mustn't suppress your sneezes because that pressure has to go somewhere. So now I don't suppress my sneezes. And it's quite disconcerting because it's very loud. And I always have to apologise and explain to people.
But that's hilarious. I love it.
The only good thing about it is if there's a piano player in the room, if I get an inkling that there's one coming, I just say, quick, jump on the sustain pedal. And, like, it's fantastic, the overtones.
Sort of after piano. Oh, I like that.
It's worth it.
Can't be a keyboard, then.
No. Useless for that.
For many.
Wow.
Yeah. But, yeah, if it's a grand piano with the lid up, I'm telling you, man, it's like... Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, my favourite of all. Do you know Jeremy Brown?
Is he a bassist?
Yeah, he taught me at Academy.
Ah, of course, yeah.
Get a photo of him up before I tell you this one. Have a quick Google.
Anyone listening to this is going to be able to... in real time with me, if you're sitting at your computer. Right, I've got a... Oh, wait, I forgot to write bassist and all kinds of weird stuff is coming up. Jeremy Brown, bassist, who taught Dan at Academy. Press enter. Images. Okay, that seems to have sorted it out a little bit. Right, yeah, go on, I got him.
Go on. No, that's not Jeremy Brown. Oh, yeah, that's someone else. I've Googled it with you. He's the top left.
Mm-hmm.
First one.
Yeah.
You got a photo of him up?
Yeah.
Ostrich farmer.
He's got the right facial expression for an ostrich farmer in that picture.
Yeah. What would Reuben Fowler's alternative profession be?
Well, I guess he's a sandwich reviewer. He's kind of...
Well, that's what he reads. But what? Just by looking at him, what would his job be?
Just by looking at him? I'd like to think that he's a fur coat salesman or a model.
That is good, yeah. Or, very good. Or was it Kim Jong-un Eagle's lookalike?
Yes, of course.
No,
that's a great one.
Body double.
Yeah.
Kim Jong, from North Korea.
My personal... My personal favourite on this list is Paul Klavis, Cosmonaut.
Yeah, I saw that one. Yeah. There's some really great ones on there. Leon Greening. Leon Greening's is great. Door-to-door tea towel seller. Yeah.
We could do this all night and just not... Right? Yeah, maybe one week when we haven't got a guest, we could just talk about this for an hour.
Great, isn't
it? Hmm. It is, yeah, it's amazing.
Really great. Just, I love all the bracketed things as well.
Yeah. Yeah, what works here is how much time and effort has gone into every last one. There's no garbage here. There's no spare information.
No. Gary Husband, Lion Tamer. Yes, exactly.
Mm.
What would Trish be?
Well, I gave her quite a run about that trouser-making business, so I have to stick with it now.
Yeah, she's in some sort of like fabric.
Mm.
Fabric work, isn't she?
Maybe she could do costume design for a BBC historical drama.
Period drama.
Yeah. Look out, Poldark season 3.
Oh, dear. Oh, Tina May, assistant at Selfridge's perfume department. Oh, Jim Mullen, Megaplex bowling shoe attendant. Oh, dear, this is so great. That's some really good ones.
I can hear the ending music. That means it's time.
Does that mean we've got to go?
We've got to go.
Oh, I wanted to ask you, though, before we go.
Yeah, do it.
Did Loz ever call you back?
Yeah, but he didn't leave me a voicemail, so...
He didn't leave you a voicemail?
No, I specifically told him. I even sent him a text being like, man, if you call me, make it a voicemail, because, you know, I can't play a missed call to anybody.
Well, look, Loz, if you're listening, call Rob back.
Yeah. And if I don't pick up, leave me a voicemail. Obviously, that's...
So you mentioned... You mentioned who's next week. We've got Kit coming on.
Kit
next week.
Downs is going to come and talk to us about music. And he's got I think it's his first album coming out on ECM this year. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about organs.
Great.
Yeah, it's going to be cool.
I'm going to Barcelona next Friday.
That sounds devastatingly nice.
I'm going to have to record the next one from Barcelona.
Sweet. We're going to do some...
Going international.
Yeah, we are. This is going to be huge. We're gonna be big in the Barcelona jazz scene in a couple of weeks' time, because you can go and campaign. Put that T-shirt on we made.
Oh, yeah. Rob made me a jazz podcast T-shirt. I'll have to take a photo for Twitter.
That's a very nice idea. We thought about sending one to each guest as well, until I worked out that would cost about 140 quid a year.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
So if anyone wants to sponsor us to send each guest a jazz That's podcast great. T-shirt, get in touch.
Great idea. You could buy... We could do like a crowdfund. Buy Steve Berry a jazz podcast T-shirt.
That's great. I mean, we only need to fund about £3.50 per shirt.
I reckon we can make this happen.
I've got a good feeling. It's £11 a month that we need to raise.
Okay. Beautiful. To bring four people to jazz podcast T-shirt.
Enrich four lives ever so slightly. Yeah. It's been a pleasure, Dan, as
have
always.
Have a great week, Rob. Yeah, have a great week.
Beautiful. Until Friday.